leftovers, or the DMV, or house cleaning, or Chumba Casino always brings the fun. Play over 100 different games online for free from anywhere. You could redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. Live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus
terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Real love isn't about grand gestures. It's about the perfect pairing. So get out of here with that puny rose and get down on one knee with a dozen Dunkin' Brownie Batter donuts with a decadent Coca Mocha signature latte to match. If you really want something special, sip on a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' Refresher with a sweet Cupid's Choice donut. Take an arrow straight to the taste buds because Dunkin's bringing the love this Valentine's Day. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Gina, creator and host of Feminine Roadmap Podcast, the podcast that is designed to have real talk around all things midlife and strategies to help us live a more vibrant second half. It is my deepest desire to help other people shift the conversation toward empowerment, toward vibrancy, toward excitement about what life has for us and what we can bring to the world, how we can each individually shine our light. So I invite you to grab a cup of something wonderful, to join me each week or when you can, and join me in my living room to have these conversations. And if you are enjoying this, please take the time to subscribe wherever you listen, rate my podcast, and share the episodes that help you, the episodes that encourage you. Let's build this community together. Welcome to my tribe. I'm so grateful you're here.
Hello, Feminine Roadmappers. It's Gina here with Feminine Roadmap Podcast, the podcast that helps you navigate the challenges and the changes of midlife. Today, we are going to be talking about widowhood and midlife dating. My guest today was widowed in 2013 at the age of 49. That led her to write a book and get a master's degree. And her book is about finding love after becoming a widow. And today, she's going to share her story with us. My guest is Debbie Weiss. She's a former lawyer, and she's the author of Available As Is, A Midlife Widow's Search for Love. Debbie, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
I'm excited to hear your story. You and I have not had a chance to talk much. You found me. I said, yes, here we are. And your book isn't available until September 13th. So I'm excited to help promote that. And so I would love to have you share your story with my audience. Tell us about you becoming a widow and this journey you've taken to share it in book form.
Thank you. My husband had cancer. He was diagnosed in 2009, and he did pretty well for a while. He was a tech guy, he was an engineer, but he passed in April of 2013. And that led me to start writing. I was pretty isolated. I'm a former lawyer, but I hadn't been practicing for about 10 years around then. And I just started to try to put a life together. And what helped me a great deal was writing. I started to take some writing classes. And from there, I met friends and joined a writing group and started to write it my experiences of being widowed and what that was like. And I didn't think my writing was up to par. I write like a lawyer. So I also got a master's of fine arts and creative writing in May of 2020.
That's fantastic. What a journey, really, that you took to find a way to cope and then to end up with a book that's going to be an encouragement to so many people. And really, when you reached out to me, I thought, this is such an important conversation because there's got to be other women like you.
I find them everywhere. I swim laps at the local pool, and the woman next to me was a widow of a few months. I was reaching out to another author to chat. She'd been widowed about 8 months ago. We're everywhere. We just don't seem to talk about it a lot, which I think is unfortunate because it is such a major life change and then results in, I feel like, a change to the whole person.
I would imagine that there's a real feeling of isolation because you go from, you know, marriage, family, this specific lifestyle and role, and it's who you are, right? I'm a wife, I'm a mother, or I'm a lawyer. How was that for you being suddenly single in a time when most of us don't expect to become suddenly single?
Yeah, I certainly didn't. My husband was my high school sweetheart, my prom date. We'd been together 32 years when he passed. I didn't expect to be alone. And it was probably worse because we didn't have any kids. Our parents were our older, obviously. And then, you know, he'd been an engineer and he was pretty antisocial. I was kind of a bookworm. I was antisocial. So when he passed, I was super isolated. I could spend days not really talking to another person if I didn't get out and do something. So it was very dramatic. And I had to start thinking about what I could do to be less isolated in this situation. It was kind of surreal. It was surreal.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what was your kind of journey like? If somebody's going through this, how did you navigate that? I mean, we have the short version, right? That you started to write a book and whatnot. And you had done a blog as well at that time. So give me a little bit of a how to deal with such a tragic situation at an age when that's not what you expect to be doing. So what was it that you did to kind of find your way through?
Well, Gina, what's interesting is that there are a lot of people who are very brave and they take these big steps. And I've certainly heard of people who are widowed who they travel the world or they join an ashram. That's not me. I'm a very cautious kind of person. I take small steps. My mother died when I was 10, and that left me a very kind of cautious person because from then on, I kind of knew somebody could vanish at any time unexpectedly. So the thing that helped me and that I talk about a bit and write about is taking little steps forward. So it was a matter of joining a yoga studio and finding other midlife women. And from there, a lot of them were single. We formed a group of friends. So then I had, you know, some things to do. It was looking at what I liked to do, which was always writing. So I started to take an adult writing class. And that gave me a group of people to see once a week and assignments and more structure. Some of the more serious folks in the class had a writing group. They invited me. And from there, I started to make, you know, the first close friends I'd made in so many years. So it doesn't sound huge, you know, like at one point I started hiking and I looked at meetup groups and I joined meetup hiking groups on the weekends. Again, a lot of those folks are single, friendly. And so I started to just kind of put together a small social life in very small steps.
It's really interesting, Debbie, that I think every single person that's on my podcast community is like at the top of the list of things that are necessary to navigate whatever we're talking about, the importance of that friendship, that connection, having that network, because that isolation is probably pretty devastating on top of it.
It is. It's bizarre because before I hadn't have a lot of close friends, but you know, I had my activities. I'd go to the gardening store. I gardened a lot, or the gym. But I wasn't really concerned with finding community in those places. My husband and I had dinner together every night. We didn't spend a lot of time apart. So it was very odd when he was gone not to have anybody to eat a meal with or to have anybody ask me about my day. His parents were extremely nice and took me on a vacation after he passed. They went to Europe about 4 months later and they took me, and it was a cruise. It was older people. And what was so odd was on the cruise, again, I was so alone and it was all couples. And it was just such an odd feeling, even to be traveling, but to feel very alone, like I was in this pod.
You know, I've heard that before, that it's a kind of an overwhelming sense of being alone, even if you're in a room full of people. Is that kind of an accurate description for you?
It was for me. You know, originally I just tried to find groups to join to get me out of the house sometimes. You know, I joined Rotary. They did a weekly dinner. they're kind of career oriented. I didn't have a career at that point. I joined a car club. My husband, again, he was a techie. He had a sports car. So I joined a car club. They had breakfast on Saturday morning. So that was something to do. I could listen to people talk about carburetors. But you have to find the right groups or you just feel more lonely. You know, for me, and this was just me, this isn't for everyone. And again, newly widowed, I didn't do very well, say, going to an evening event where there's a dinner or something and you eat by yourself and you're, you know, you're alone. I did better with trying to find groups of folks who were single and who were doing, you know, real activities. You kind of get your workout in. And again, you find more other single folk. But yeah, I did have that experience very much. Even if a kind couple would invite me over, I would just always feel like there was this sort of imaginary empty chair next to me where George, my late husband, should have been.
I'm sure that the grieving journey is different for everyone, but there are probably some things that everybody experiences. What was your grieving journey like? Was it long? I mean, because with something like a terminal diagnosis, I suppose there's a dual life that you live, right? There's the hope, but the possible expectancy of the passing of that loved one. How was that journey for you?
Well, at first it was difficult. You know, at first I was very hopeful. My husband was very strong at the beginning. He took himself to chemo. He didn't lose his appetite, but he also went into denial. So he didn't think he was dying. And that was very difficult. We never had a real goodbye. His body was in terrible shape. He was refusing to get enough adequate care. He was refusing services the hospital offered. He also shut me out of his treatment. So it made the death very difficult. And I had a tremendous amount of guilt. So sadly enough, the beginning of my grief journey, I wouldn't call it self-destructive, but I would call it very strange. I was alone. I drank in the evenings, hence my blog name, The Hungover Widow, and eventually sort of took up an inappropriate relationship with my late husband's much younger caregiver, which was not the best choice, but was kind of all I could come up with from being alone day in and day out. I was probably a little bit unhinged.
Sounds a little bit like an emotional slingshot. Like, you know, you're being drawn back and then you just launch because you don't know what to aim for.
That's true. You're absolutely right. You know, as a former lawyer, when I had all the paperwork to do, we had a trust. It wasn't a huge amount of stuff, but getting things in my name and all that, my husband had been sort of took care of everything on his own. He was the man. And, you know, so I had about, I don't know, some number of months, probably 6 months, sorting all that out. And I would do that every day like a job. And at night, I was just kind of far flung. You know, I was very unmoored. But it was very difficult to try to kind of get some sense of balance again.
Were there processes that were helpful to you, or did you navigate it all alone?
Oh, you know, grief therapy is very helpful. I really recommend grief therapy. You know, someone to tell me, hey, you don't have to have this guilt. This isn't your fault, because I was so overwhelmed with guilt. I didn't see myself having much of a future. And so what really helped me was grief therapy. And also with the inappropriate situation I was in, it was nice to have the therapist say, you don't have any guilt. You're in a very vulnerable place. This guy shouldn't have been interested in you in that way. So it was kind of validating. And I had someone to talk to. And she also had concrete advice. Like she'd say, okay, you have to go out of the house. You have to tell one person you're a widow. But after that, what really, really helped me was writing. Because from there, I got a group of friends who were like-minded. And once I started writing, I was a blogger at the Huffington Post. And I put up some stuff about caregiver guilt. And I had like one time in a few hours, I had maybe 90 comments from people who were saying, I've been there too. It's not your fault. So even though it was a virtual community, that was very helpful to know I wasn't alone in suffering from the guilt of having been such a poor, such an imperfect caregiver.
Yeah, caregiving is a bit of a conundrum, right? Because we love the person that we're caring for, but we have our own frustrations and needs, and really not knowing where the end of that caregiving is going to be. I have caregiven for my mother-in-law, and making the decisions, depending on the kind of decisions you make, are challenging. I can only imagine how much more challenging in a marriage as a woman, because there's role, very specific roles, you know, that you've lived in for so long.
Yes.
And it puts you in a very awkward situation, I would imagine.
Well, it basically didn't put me in a situation at all, which was worse. My husband was treated at the same facility where my mother had died, again, when I was 10. What was extremely difficult was my husband put an order in place so the medical staff at the hospital couldn't contact me directly. It would have to go through him. That really added to my guilt. It made me feel that I was, you know, inadequate to participate in his care. But it was odd because I did function well. And I, you know, again, I'm a former lawyer. I can deal with some difficult situations. And I was certainly in my right mind. It was also kind of counterproductive because if he couldn't make decisions, I'd be the one who would have to make them. So having me be informed made a lot of sense. But I think the denial messed with his brain. It was a difficult space for him. And he was so used to being in control. I think in the beginning he tried to be helpful, but slid into something that was more dangerous.
Mm. And how long was this process for you?
Well, he was diagnosed in 2009. He didn't really start to do poorly until the fall of probably 2012. He had about really only the last 6 months before he passed were really poor. But it was those last 6 months where things were very difficult because I didn't feel I was taking care of him properly. His body was falling apart. We weren't talking about that. He was refusing the kind of outside care I thought we should have. He got pneumonia. You know, the hospital sent him home when he really, I don't think, should have been sent home. And again, he didn't understand the kind of shape he was in. He just kept working. He thought he was going to recover. So that added an extra layer that was very difficult. Mm-hmm.
It's challenging enough to be in relationship with another person, as we all have our, you know, challenges, quirks. That layer of his, it sounds like, inability to cope with the reality of this cancer. So how did blogging begin? Did it begin before or after he passed?
Oh, I didn't start blogging until probably probably 14 months after he passed. I really didn't start blogging until I started dating again. At that point, you know, I was functioning more. I had a little bit more bandwidth, though not much of a brain. If you look back at my early blog posts, they're terrible. But I'd started dating and I was really sort of disgusted with the quality of middle-aged men in the modern world. And I felt that people should know.
So let's talk about that. What was your dating journey? I've talked to a couple of other women about midlife dating, not necessarily in connection with widowhood, but just what is it like? Because, I have daughters that are, I have a 31-year-old and a 28-year-old, and I know their frustrations. I'm kind of curious about what your frustrations have been.
Well, I started originally on JDate, which is a site for Jewish people. I'm not terribly religious, but I thought it might be a bit more of a training ground before some huge site. And I just really met people who were super self-involved, still living with their exes. It really felt like everybody was living in the past. They were so disillusioned. Nobody had any hope. And I felt that continue as I went on to other sites and met more people and really didn't find any joy in the process. You know, it was pretty depressing. And at this point, I was coming out of a year, you know, I didn't start dating for a year after I was widowed. And I was sort of coming out of this looking to find joy again, and at least to have some fun and maybe meet some interesting people. But everybody seemed pretty depressed, which surprised me as a widow.
Interesting. Living with their exes?
Well, living with the memories of their exes, you know, I'd go on a date and all I would hear was, well, my ex-wife did this and I'm really pissed about that. And she got the house and now I'm in this apartment and I'm never going to let that happen again. And this girlfriend dumped me. And, you know, it was just this litany of complaints and things that went wrong. you know, it's funny, my very, it's in my book, my first date after I was widowed, I was on J date and I find this guy and he's great looking, looks like a healthy Alec Baldwin, he funny. And I meet him, and we, you know, hang out a bit. And then we go to our first dinner date and he spent that night going through not one, but four exes. We went to a romantic dinner in San Francisco so he could talk about all these exes. And typical things like that kept happening. And it was like, well, this is a disaster. You know, people need to know.
People need to know this really sucks.
Yeah, kind of this really sucks. Be prepared for it.
Yeah.
Have your guard up. You know, people are pushy. I also think something that weird that's happened in middle-aged people is maybe they look at some of the way younger folks sort of hook up and they're more casual and they think they can be the same way. So, you know, I was used to dating. I hadn't dated since I was in high school where the boy, you know, usually wears a little nice outfit and picks you up and you have a planned date. And now, you know, you're getting guys who have very poor manners, complain a lot. And, you know, I was kind of shocked when after a very lackluster first date, the guy calls me for a second date and says, hey, do you want to come over to my place and hot tub? You know, I just kind of didn't like the casualness of it all. And I didn't feel like these guys seemed to think they could just hook up. And that wasn't what I wanted. And I was kind of disgusted by that.
That's so fascinating because honestly, that's kind of what my daughter's experienced. It's interesting how the mindset has changed. I kind of thought it was an age-related thing, but maybe it's a cultural shift that's been happening somehow. I don't know what that is, but it's very similar.
That's interesting. So I write on Medium. I wrote a lot about dating on the Medium publication site. And I would hear from women of different ages that, hey, you're not alone. This is happening, you know, to gals in their 30s as well. And so I do think you have a good point that it is like a cultural shift. And somehow that cultural shift is away from what I would call, you know, traditional manners, for want of a better word. But somehow it did seem to be this hookup thing. And also sort of this negotiation thing. No, I don't want to see you. Oh, come on. We're both alone. You know, real pushiness. And I found that just disheartening.
Debbie, from your experience, what is it that's important for you to tell other women? I'm sure men are going through it too, but primarily we've got women that are listening. So what is it important for you to let people know about your experience?
Well, what I'd want people to know is that you can feel better after being widowed. Life can improve, but it takes so much longer than you think. I really would hope to help people understand that, you know, at 2 years, you really don't feel better. I certainly didn't. In fact, at that point, I was getting probably a little bit worse because I was realizing this is my life now. He really is gone. I really am alone. I'm going to have to craft something new. But it does get better. It just takes a really long time, and it takes a really long time for your brain to recover. I'd also want to share that little steps forward can start to add up to a new life. It doesn't sound like much, but for me, it was taking those small steps forward that started to make a big difference. You know, from being really sad and getting up off the couch and saying, okay, I'm going to go to this yoga class. And then there were a couple women in the class and I talked to them. And then one evening they invited me for drinks. And then suddenly I did have a community of women friends for a bit. And that was valuable. Or, you know, I was in a very bad relationship. It ended. I was very sad. It was difficult. And one morning I said, okay, looked at Meetup, said, okay, I'll pick a hike. I'm going to get out of the house. And from there, I had a whole new hobby. So I guess I want to talk about the road being very long, not linear. It's twisted. But also that, you know, you can go on to have some measure of happiness later. You just really have to have faith in the future. And that if you make mistakes, God knows I did, certain inappropriate relationships, dating mishaps, you're not alone. You know, we make these mistakes, but you're still you. You can recover and go on to craft a new life and find happiness again.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I love that you shared that the road is crooked and not linear, because I think naturally we kind of want to get from point A to point B, especially when we're trying to get through something, right? If I can just get to the other side of whatever it is, we're kind of trying so hard to get to the other side. But we really don't know what the other side looks like, do we?
We don't know what the other side looks like. And after being widowed, it's not that simple because, like, what's the other side? Is it, for some people, maybe it's moving. For some people, maybe it's being partnered. For some people, it's being single or finding a new business. And when you get to the other side, you're a different person. You change a lot through widowhood. I think what's hard is you're kind of creating a new self. And in that way, it feels like going back to adolescence, especially dating, trying to make friends, trying to find partners. So it really does feel like going back to high school or something again in a funny way. And there's so many different pieces, like, where do you want to live? What do you want to do? How do you make friends as a middle-aged person when most people already seem to have their groups of friends? So there's just so many different pieces that you have to put in play. And at least for me, by the time I was done with that, I was pretty different from where I'd started.
Would you say that, if looking back on your marriage, what would you have done different relationally? Or is there anything you would have done different as a woman independently that could have made the transition a little different for you?
Well, I was pretty antisocial. I really pretty much followed my husband's lead. You know, we both talked a lot about things, but if one of us was going to win, it was him. Mm. And he wanted to live a very certain way. He was a workaholic. He didn't want to travel. He didn't enjoy socializing very much. You know, his workday was a mass of meetings. He was the tech lead on Quicken for Windows for Intuit. So his job was all consuming, and then his time with me. And looking back, I'm surprised I didn't develop more of my own interests after I quit practicing law, and that I didn't realize how important friendship could be, or that it was a really important component of our lives. You know, we pretty much just shared everything with each other, and that was it. And I'm not sure that's really great for any relationship anyway.
That's interesting. You know, I do know a couple like that, and I'm always thinking, gosh, they don't have any outside interests or any outside relationships. And what happens if, right? That crosses my mind. So it's interesting to hear you share that, because I have a couple of those people in my life where I just think it's almost like, I don't know if you were like this, but like, they can't go anywhere without each other. Like, it's, there's no way to be separate from each other at all. My husband and I actually have been together since right out of high school as well. And so all of my adult life, and I'm sure you and I can relate on this, when you've been with someone all of your adult life, it's literally every memory, everything you've done, every place you've gone. And it does become very much all encompassing. But we personally, at least me, I've tried to make sure that we both have some things that we do that are separate so that we have something interesting to bring back to our relationship. Did you find for you that as you seek another partner, potentially even just as a friendship, that you're thinking about that differently, them as a part of the whole instead of the whole?
Yes, actually, I am partnered. I have been with someone for 4 years now.
Nice.
We moved in together into a new home a year ago, which was wonderful. I hadn't realized what was really good for me was leaving the house that I'd lived in with my late husband, which I'd lived in for 27 years. And I really hadn't thought to do that, but I moved to a new town, new home, and that really made a huge difference. But it is something I think about in my relationship now, because we enjoy spending time together, but at the same time, I want to keep up the interests and people that I cultivated when I was widowed, so that I do have interests and things to talk about and things to bring home and other folks to bounce ideas off and connection. It makes for a much richer life. So yeah, that is something I think about a lot as I'm in this relationship. And it's funny because, you know, again, I know George since I was 17. So this is a 4-year relationship, but to me, it feels very new.
Yeah, I can imagine. See, now for me, and Debbie, this is just me picking your brain, that I imagine getting a hobby. I feel like it's so brave to go back out there and go through all of the steps and processes with another person after all the years of the habits and experiences that you've had. So obviously it's easy for me to make that kind of cavalier judgment on this side, because I'm not in your situation. But I've always joked that I would get a hobby or like move to Europe and live my dream in an English cottage. But of course, grief and life don't deliver to us what we imagine it will be. Am I right?
They don't. I mean, I'd always imagined that I would travel with my late husband, that he would retire eventually from Intuit. He did well, and, you know, and that he would retire at a fairly young age and we would travel. I don't know that he actually wanted to travel. After he passed, I did some trips to Europe by myself with a UC alumni group just so that I could travel. And it was a bit lonely, but it was also a growth experience to be with this group of people. And there were usually in that least a few women on their own, maybe their husbands didn't travel or were ill or something. So they would come and help and, you know, talk to me, and I would get a little group of friends on those trips and I would explore the world. So that was really good, taking some trips, but I'd never thought I would do that on my own. And it honestly wasn't my first choice. It was a matter of saying, well, this is what you have available. This is what you can do. And again, I'm a very cautious person. I'm not the person who, you know, goes to the airport, sees what's available, grabs a flight and is gone for months. You know, again, I needed to do the things that cautious, anxious people do.
What did you do for that cautious, anxious Debbie? How did you help that side of your personality navigate? How did you find the courage? Because really, it was courageous to do those things.
Thank you. I'm so used to people saying, oh, why don't you just join an ashram, or you don't have kids, you can just go, you know, travel around for a while. And it's like, but that's not me. I'm a homebody. I found courage. Well, again, therapy is good, but also just kind of talking myself into it. I just made that a priority. I wouldn't say I treated it like a job, but it was just kind of, again, I'm an explorer. So I'm used to dealing with things by being organized, you know, seeing what kind of social things were in the area. I lived in kind of a limited suburb, so there wasn't a lot of stuff, but, you know, kind of seeing what's out there and just saying, you're going to go, getting, you know, propelling myself out of bed, setting the alarm clock a half hour earlier than I thought, giving myself too much time to drive there, even though I do have, you know, maps on my phone, but just really treating that kind of thing like a priority and just going to stuff and saying, this is what you're doing. Be proud of yourself. And even if it doesn't work, at least it's an attempt.
Did you experience some things that after you did it, you were like, yeah, I didn't enjoy that. Like, were you just totally testing the waters in all kinds of ways?
Yeah, I did. Like I said, Rotary really wasn't for me. It's very structured. It's kind of geared towards, you know, cultivating business. I didn't really have a business. I did a few meetup groups for women, but some of those turned out to be more like someone comes in and tries to sell you something, and that didn't really, you know, work for me. So a lot of stuff I did didn't work. I joined a car club. I really liked the people, but I also tried a track day. So there I was in my late husband's old Porsche trying to navigate a track, and I am not a good driver. This was not a success. So that wasn't a big one either. I'm not religious, but I did join a synagogue. And again, that for the most part didn't work for me terribly well. Most of those folks were married and had, you know, school-age kids, so that wasn't a huge success. But I did get grief counseling from the rabbi. So, you know, most things had some element that was educational to me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I can learn from everything. And I certainly at least got used to doing things like walking into a room of people I don't know as a single person, which is probably a useful thing to do if you're going to promote a book.
You know, that is a skill, especially for introverted homebodies. Like, that is an actual practicable, intentional habit, right? If, like, for me, not an introvert, not. So we was just discussing with someone how for me to go into a room full of strangers is not a big deal. I know that I can find someone to talk to. So I think as I listen to your story, Debbie, you have this history with someone since high school. And then you've built a life kind of quietly with that one person. And your tendency is to be a homebody, and you're an introvert. And so from an outsider's perspective, what I see is a lot of tenacity and courage. No matter how it felt to you, you didn't stay stuck. You didn't stay in unhealthy situations. And I think that it's encouraging for someone listening that this imperfect journey that you took, these fits and starts and stumbles, right, were part of that journey for you. And everyone's journey is probably going to look a little bit different, but there may be, you've got the emotional side, right, of what you were talking about, the grief, the guilt. You have the psychological side, because you're like, oh my gosh, I feel like I've gone back to high school. Most of us wouldn't go back to high school if you paid us $1 million. You know, we're like, no, thank you. You've been there, done that. So it sounds like your journey was so multi-layered that maybe part of the journey is just acknowledging that reality and celebrating any wins to get your feet under you.
That's how I feel. I wished I'd been easier on myself. I mean, that's the one thing I would tell, like to tell, you know, someone who is grieving and or divorced and, you know, going out there and feeling vulnerable, and it sucks.
Mm.
And, but, you know, I always felt I was doing it wrong. I was seeing these other widows, and there's, you know, blogs of widows, fit widows, singing widows. I mean, they were all doing something more positive than I was. I was drinking Manhattans and listening to, you know, Rolling Stones albums. It wasn't, you know, but I do think that, yeah, I wish I'd been gentler with myself. And I think that every, and kind of treat everything as a victory. You know, you try something, you get off the couch, you go, you try to something different and meet new people, and just to say, well, that's, you know, that's a good step forward.
Mm. If you could kind of time it, because now it's been about 9 years for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming up on 9.
And you've been in this relationship for 4.
Yeah.
So it was a 5-year journey for you.
It was a 5-year journey. It was. One thing that probably made it odder for me is I did want to find love again. That was very important to me. Then the first thing I had to do was kind of find myself and what I liked and what I wanted to do. So that's kind of what the book is about. When I was taking my MFA classes, we would do this thing about, my book is about X, but it's really about Y. And, you know, I would say, well, my book is about searching for love, but it's really about finding self-love and self-esteem. So for me, it was a lot of different steps, but I did really want to find love again. So I probably wasted far too much time online or dating. I kind of justified that by being a writer, saying I was collecting experiences.
Just getting a dossier of awful experiences.
They weren't supposed to be awful.
How different are you now from that woman 9 years ago?
Well, in some ways, it's funny. I'm kind of the same. I went through a phase of being pretty different. I was a little more wild for a ways because I never stayed out overnight or had crazy dates or done anything. And now I'm kind of like back to center of still being a cautious, introverted person. But I'm definitely a lot braver and I'm more forthcoming and I can talk to people. I was very, very shy. I couldn't really talk to people. It was kind of odd and it didn't serve me well as a lawyer, but it helped me to become much more outgoing and much more interested in other people, which is really cool because when you talk to someone and you discover their passion, that's really cool. I mean, that's what you do. And I think that's neat when you get people to open up. I probably have more self-esteem because I've been put down by guys and realized, you know, that's not how that should be. And more tenacious about my goals. I never would have gotten a master's degree or written a book. So I think I definitely wound up more focusing a little bit like follow. It's kind of a cliche, but the idea of like finding your passion or following your dreams.
Do you have any sense of regret? The woman that you've become now, do you look back and regret that you didn't exercise some of these muscles you didn't know you had? So these brave muscles, adventurous in your way muscles. Do you look back and do you struggle with regret? I'm curious if this is something that might help another person listening.
I don't, because you can't. I mean, you can't. You know, you can only deal with who you are at a given moment. I mean, I love being married to my husband. In some ways, I didn't do much. You know, my law career, being a lawyer, was pretty intense. So I was pretty grateful to end it and just be a recovering lawyer. So I wasn't, you know, by the time I quit law, I didn't really have a lot of professional ambitions. I'd sort of seen what a hassle it was to try to make those come true. And I was happy to withdraw. a lot of sexism when I was a lawyer in the early 90s, in the 90s, a lot of sexism you wouldn't have expected. But I don't regret anything. I mean, I love my husband and we had a fairy tale kind of life. He protected me from everything. I don't know if I would have stayed that way, but I can't regret it. It was just, I think of it as just a different time.
That's good. That's good. Having not gone through it, I was just processing different emotions that might become a challenge. So if there were three things that you could give to the listeners, takeaways that you think are important, if someone's in your shoes, maybe they haven't found that love yet, you know, what advice do you have for them?
Okay. Are we asking for people who are looking for love or people who are widowed? I will tailor my advice.
You know what? Why don't you give me a couple for each? Because you do have a dual topic and they're both very important, I think.
Oh, thank you. Well, for widowhood, I would say, don't worry if you don't feel like you're getting better quickly enough. It takes years. It took me about 3 years before I felt like I had my brain power back. That's one thing. Second is, it's really difficult, but it does help to get off the couch and find a few like-minded folks to hang out with. You know, I started with daily walks, just saying hello to the same people. And then from there, it was hiking groups. And those groups had a lot of social activities. So I would say definitely taking a few cautious baby steps forward can start to lead to the things that you might need, like friendships or community. For dating, God, don't settle. I tried that. You know, some guys, they're not perfect. Or it's not a matter of perfection. They're not well-behaved and I put up with too much crap. I'll leave it at that. Don't settle for what you don't want, I think is super important. Two, it takes a really long time and you have to be tenacious. I mean, I just stayed online and eventually I did find the right person online, but it took 5 years. I'm not sure if I'm one of these people who believes the universe provides, but I do think that I almost needed those 5 years to put myself together. By the time I met my partner, I traveled, I was going to get my MFA. I had a trip to Eastern Europe planned and I was kind of a whole person on my own. So putting the two together, I would say, when you're widowed, don't date again until you have a good sense of yourself and your self-esteem and being able to stand up for yourself and knowing what you want. Don't rush in too soon, because I did. And that was a waste of time. And I was too busy focusing on other people instead of seeing what I needed to do to create a real life on my own.
That's such profound advice, Debbie.
Thank you.
Don't date until you know who you are and what you want. Because I would think that after a long-term relationship, of course, everything is somewhat clear and plug and play after 35 years, you know, or 32 years. You kind of haven't thought about what would I like, because you're in something, you know what I mean?
Yes. So yeah. You don't think about it. You don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you have to meet yourself again, don't you?
You do. You have to meet yourself again. And it's hard because at least when I had this kind of loss, there wasn't a lot of self there. There was just a lot of pain. So you almost have to regrow yourself.
Well, Debbie, I'm so grateful that you reached out to me. And it has been so lovely to hear your journey and your heart and the brutal honesty that you shared it, because I think that's really where the beauty of the conversation is. It's not like, oh, just do X, Y, and Z, but it's like, no, this journey can be messy. It can be difficult. And I appreciate the graciousness with which you shared it. And I believe that your message is meant to be heard, because women need to know that there is hope. I think hope is so necessary in all areas of life, but especially when you've been put in such a difficult situation like you were.
Thank you, Dean. I really appreciate that. I enjoyed doing this. And I agree. I think hope is the most important thing, because when it's really dark, you just have to believe that things can get better, and they can. It just takes way longer than you think.
But isn't that true about everything, really? You know?
Yeah. Yes.
You're like, dang, I really thought I was going to have that done by now. I feel like that's a life-ism. I thought I'd have that done by now.
You're right. You're right.
Dang it. Time. What kind of enemy is time? But it sounds like in this particular situation, time is actually not your enemy. It's sort of a buffer to make sure that you get on your feet again. How can people find you? Where is your book going to be? Because again, it comes out September 13th. So this is ahead of time, about a month ahead.
Okay. My book, the easiest way is to pre-order it on Amazon. That is the simplest way. But if you don't like Amazon, and I am conscious that a lot of people do not, there is a link on my website to go to, like, that'll put you in touch with an indie bookstore, or you can just order it at your bookstore. I'm with She Writes Press. It has standard distribution. So if you go to your bookstore and ask for my book, available as is, A Midlife Widow's Search for Love, you should be able to order it. I have my website, thehungoverwidow.com, and I'm most active on Facebook, where I'm me, Debbie Weiss, and my author page, which is Debbie Weiss also, Debbie Weiss, The Hungover Widow, I believe. So you can find me. I'm there. I even put one video up on TikTok and was sort of shocked by the whole thing. But yes, I'm around. But the best way to get the book is to order it on Amazon. And if you want to pre-order it, it's a big help to me, because I'm trying to get the book visible. And if the new author, that's really hard.
Well, awesome. Friends, if you head over to www.feminineroadmap.com/episode 281, I will have links for you to find Debbie and Debbie's book, in case you want a shortcut. Debbie Weiss is a woman who has endured her husband's cancer, widowhood, finding her way back to center and finding love. And that is the message of hope that we wanted to bring to you today, that no matter where you find yourself on this journey of life, remember that there's always hope. And yes, there will be difficult times. And yes, it will be challenging. And obviously, time is going to feel different for different people in your journeys. But we do want to encourage you to stay the course, cling to hope, be tenacious, be gentle with yourself, give yourself the support you need in community, therapy, whatever it takes, and know that there is a way through. It may look a little different for you, but it's going to happen. So if you are interested at all in reaching out to Debbie, I will have those links for you. She also has a blog. You can find the link to that in the show notes as well. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. If this conversation has been an encouragement to you, please take the time to like it, subscribe it, and share it, and go pre-order Debbie's book. Thank you so much for listening today, friends. We appreciate your time, and we look forward to sharing more inspirational stories with you in the weeks to come. Take care, my friends. Bye-bye.
Leftovers or the DMV
number 97
or house cleaning or Chumba Casino always brings the fun. Play over 100 different games online for free from anywhere. You could redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. Live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.